You're listening to the Functional Nerds Podcast with your hosts, Patrick Hester and Tracy Townsend. Tracy, we are back. It's Saturday. We are recording a podcast once again. It's a good day.
Yeah. Most is right in the world.
Most is right in the world again.
Which, you know, seems like about the amount of rounding up that we get in 2026.
So. Yes.
So
considering the weirdness that is the world these days.
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. Like we can, this year is going to be a time capsule of something. That's for sure.
I made a huge mistake in between recording our episodes today.
Oh no.
I looked at the news. I feel like the news these days is similar to the comments. You never read the comments.
Okay.
You should never look at the news.
Okay. Dare I ask what you're just – no, you know what? Let's not go there.
No.
You looked at the news and it was a mistake. And
I looked at the news. It was a mistake.
We will make better choices.
Yes, we will.
Well, among our better choices is, you know, satisfying my own little sort of peccadilloes. We talked before about how I'm kind of obsessed with translation.
Yes.
And part of the reason why I'm obsessed with it is I come to English as a single and solitary speaker of English, but a dabbler in a number of other languages in nothing more than a Duolingo-ish kind of way. And because so much of what I get excited about in translation is based on things that I have no direct experience with, anytime we have the opportunity to talk to a translator, I sort of love to pounce all over it. So that's part of the reason why I'm super delighted to have Anton Herr on today. Anton is a science fiction and fantasy author in his own right, but also a translator, and most recently has translated Kim Cho Yup's If We Cannot Go at the Speed of Light, which should be coming out where you are the very week that you're listening to this podcast. Anton, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So I have a question.
By the way, Tracy,
yes,
before
yes.
you get into it, you mentioned being only one language. I actually speak two languages. I speak English and Southern.
Yeah, there's some meaningful distinctions to be found there. Yeah. So, okay, putting aside the question of your preferred language of English or Southern there, one question that I am really curious about is when you take on a translation project, Anton, like, for instance, If We Cannot Go at the Speed of Light, do you come to it having already known Kim's work? Is it an opportunity that opened before you? Is it one that you sought out? I'd love to kind of know your relationship to this text and how you came to it.
I think a really big misconception when it comes to translators, literary translators working in book translation space, is that people give us jobs. Mm-hmm. And no one really gives us jobs. We have to make the jobs ourselves. So how it happens most of the time is you find a book that you really like, and then you go to the rights holder and you beg them, may I have the rights to translate a sample of this up to 5,000 words, and then send it to American publishers, British publishers. And then they might give you the rights. Once you have these rights, you create a sample. Normally you don't get paid for it. And you go door to door, publisher to publisher, editor to editor, trying to find someone who would be interested and who wants to buy it. And then if you're very, very lucky, maybe if you've knocked on about 40 doors, although I am getting better at it as I go, then maybe like one of them will be somewhat interested. And then they give an offer to the Korean rights holder, and they give you a separate offer as the translator. And if everyone is satisfied with the offer after a long and tortured negotiations process, which could last, you know, up to a year. Mm-hmm. And I have had this process last up to a year, just the negotiations process post offer. And then everything just like fall apart. I've had that happen a couple of times, actually.
Oh.
And so once that hurdle is cleared, then you get to do your ostensibly what is your job, which is translate a book. And then you translate that, and then it comes out into the world and get to go on Functional Nerds, etc. So it's a very, very long, and it's a gamble as well.
Yeah.
So you cannot choose a book that you have lukewarm feelings for. And you can't choose a book because someone else tells you that they enjoyed this book. And then you look at it and you're like, I don't know if it's, you know, like you can't do it on feelings. And That's why, like, if I really, really like a book, I know, oh, this, that, I know that I could go through this process with them, because the like will, you know, it will help me over all of those different hurdles.
You through the struggle. Yeah.
Yeah. But yeah. And then if you become famous enough, like if you become successful enough as a translator, then people kind of start giving you jobs. And that's happening more and more in Korean as well. The big problem being editors in America and the UK are my primary market. They don't really read Korean. Like they might read French, Spanish, German, Italian, but they don't read Korean, obviously, because publishing is so white. And they can't acquire a book without a translator, without the help of a translator, that for the most part, although it is getting better now. Now you have like assistant editors who read Korean, like you're beginning to see a bit more of that. So yeah, it's, so the process is a gamble. It's very, very translator driven to this day. Even when there are agents involved, agents have to get help from translators for samples, for proposals, just to understand what this book is about and why it should be translated. So yeah, it's a very complicated process, and that's why there are so few translators in the world, in any language combination, who do this job. Like there are far more authors who make a living as authors than there are book translators who make a living translating books.
That is a really, the degree to which that is its own variation on the query process that authors go through to become traditionally published is so much more wild than I expected. I'm proud of me for asking that question. Thank you so much, Anton, for it. That's a legitimately cool behind the scenes.
And as kind of a follow-up to that, like you find a book that you love, that you're passionate about, that you want to try to get translated and published. Do you ever have multiples of those going at the same time? Like, do you do multiple queries, or are you just doing like one at a time?
You absolutely have to do multiple things. You have to have many things on the burner. Different books are in different stages of development, essentially. It's like being a movie producer, I guess. Like you have different movies and different, and you don't know which one is going to hit. You don't know which one is going to sell. And sometimes like you have like 10 things in proposal stage and you sell nothing and then you don't work for a year. But then sometimes you get shortlisted for the International Booker Prize and then everyone is interested in what you're working on now. And so you show them and then you sell 10 things at the same time. And then you find yourself translating 10 books in a year. And so it's very much, feast or famine. Very much we are just, you know, buffeted by the winds of fate. And you just have to learn how to enjoy that, I guess.
Wow.
So I would love to know what made you fall enough in love with If We Cannot Go at the Speed of Light that you're like, I will go on this insane journey with this book wherever it takes me.
The saga of translating this book just cannot be understated, because a lot of books have extremely dramatic origin stories as to how it became translated. But like this one, I can't even tell you everything that went on. But insofar as the things that I can tell you. So in the year that this book came out in Korea, it was a huge hit. But I was made aware of it when Bora Chung, the author of Curse Bunny, one of the authors that I translate, she recommended the book to me, saying, this book is amazing. You should, she's like, oh, you should stop translating me and translate her instead. And I read it the year it came out. And I was like, oh, this is such a great book. I agree. So the author, I couldn't find contact details for the author anywhere on the internet. She's very private. And so I went to the Korean publisher. And in Korea, normally the author and the Korean publisher have a percentage share of the translation rights. This isn't the case in America so much. Usually in America, the author owns 100% of translation rights, unless there's some unusual cases where, you know, world rights are acquired by the publisher. But so in Korea, so I went to the author's publisher, Donghwasia Books, and I believe they were, but Hubble, which is part of Donghwasia Books, I think. And Hubble said to me, oh, she has a management company, and they handle all of that. And so I went to the management company and they didn't reply to my email. Like, clearly they were like, oh, we don't care about this, your whatever. And so I said, okay, I forgot about it for a while. And then a couple of years later, like after Bookermania, I believe, the agent who had been hired after all of that, she reached out to me and then she said, we have this book now that we represent and we have a sample for it. It was done by, I believe it was like a recent graduate, someone who is not professional. But we want to read you the sample because we believe that it's the sample that's holding us back. And then it was this book. And I was translating a gigantic book at the time that later on became a number one New York Times bestseller. And so I was like, oh my God, I don't have time to work on a sample for this book. But it is a sort of white whale of publishing at this point because every Korean literary translator I know wanted to translate this book. So I'm like working on it on the weekend. And my husband is like, I can't believe that you're working on another book in the middle of another book. It's like book in translation inception. But I was like, this is Kim Choi. This is the white whale. Like I've wanted to translate her for, at that point, it was like 4 or 5 years at that point. So I have to be the one to bring this over the finish line. And so I gave my sample to the agent. The agent sold it in like 4 or 5 days. Like within the week, the book was sold.
Wow.
So that was like, for me, I knew like this author had been published in English, like in short story form, like a couple of times. I think there's a story in Clark's World and that sample couldn't sell the book. This other translator who did a sample couldn't sell the book. And only when it came to me where I did the sample and I managed to sell the book where it finally, this wonderful book found the translator that it truly deserved, I have to say, and it managed to. And you know, if this happened when I asked for it the first time, this conversation would be happening like, you know, years ago. But anyway, I digress. It's
right. Yeah.
And there's a lot of other things that happened behind the scenes, which at one point I was like, why am I putting myself through all this? For this one book, for this one author, like, this is not worth it. But at that point, I think I was just too entrenched in, like, too entrenched into the project to pull out. And I just, like got through all the other BS with sheer will. But yes, it was so dramatic. So much unnecessary cost borne by the translator. you cannot imagine how overjoyed I am that the book is coming out, but I also kind of like don't believe that it's going to come out, you know, in a couple of weeks.
Yeah. How could it possibly after all this time?
Exactly. Like I literally saw an early release of this book in a bookstore yesterday. And so here in Seoul, the UK edition, because that one is like, they're selling it already apparently.
Right.
But I still refuse to believe like, oh, I'm hallucinating. Like I'm not going to believe it until until it really, really happens.
I feel like Kim owes you dinner at this point. Like, it sounds like you've sort of thrown this book on your back and carried it out into the Western world on her behalf.
Like, we follow each other on Instagram, and I, you know, I didn't tell her everything that went on, or frankly, anything that went on. And I don't think she's aware of it at all. Like, she's very private. She's, like, the people around her do a very good job, you know, keeping her happy and satisfied. And I'm like, oh, like I don't think she's been exposed to this trauma. So, but I have, and yeah, if you don't love doing this, if you don't love books, then you really can't last long as a translator.
Was there ever an experience that you had like reading a book that someone else translated that, I don't want to assign a backstory to you here, but I was about to pose the question whether or not you had ever read a translation by someone else that like inspired you to want to work in that way or in that capacity. But I guess what, knowing that you both write your own original work and that you are a translator, you're kind of drawing from related but different literary and creative skills there, right? And that you must feel driven to do those things for very particular reasons. And I'm kind of curious mm-hmm. about the part of your brain that wants to make your own things and the part of your brain that wants to help things find their way to the larger world. It's a messy question.
Mm-hmm. So are you saying that do writing and translation inspire each other?
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly, yeah, that's a much more cogent way of, you've translated my question. That's how good you are at your job.
My brain, on the level of my brain, like as I experience the world, like on the interiority level, I don't experience translation and authorship differently at all when I'm doing it. If anything, writing my own stuff is much easier than translating, because with translation, it's like constant math problem after math problem after math problem. But with writing, it's like you make something up, math problem, you make something up, math problem, you make something up. And so it's a bit easier. And also being a writer is much easier than being a translator, because when you're a writer, you have your editor, your agent, like you have so many people who help you. But if you're a translator, no one really helps you. I mean, you're obviously you're edited, and I love my editors. But some, like certain publishing houses, like they'll have marketing people who are like, why am I talking to the translator right now? Like, how does this help me do my job? And then I would have to explain how a translator is essential to, you know, marketing and promoting the book. And so that's like an extra like lecture and dealing with people that comes out of that I have to do out of pocket, essentially. And so, but in the level of the writing and the translation, when I'm writing, I feel like I'm translating my own thoughts, you know, onto paper. And when you're translating, you're still translating your own thoughts onto paper, because you had these thoughts reading this book. And then so you're kind of like filtering them through the filter that is you, and then projecting it onto, you know, the paper. It's like that, something that Rick Rubin said in his book, that best-selling book about creativity. I can't remember the title. Where is it? Oh, my bookshelf. There's so many books in here. And in that book, he says, we are all prisms, and art comes like experience, or, you know, other art comes through us as a, like through light. And then using the prism of our bodies, we scatter that light into a beautiful rainbow. And that's how I feel when I'm translating the work. Sometimes I feel like I'm window blind and I'm not doing a very good job, but then I have to have faith that the power of my author's sunlight will pierce through the window blinds and still give the reader a beautiful, illuminating experience. Hopefully I'm not that. Hopefully I'm more of a prism more of the time. And so like the experience itself, it's very similar, I think.
Yeah.
In terms of, yeah. If your question was more about like what translations or what translators inspire me, that so many translators inspire me. So Korea has a lot of really great translations from Japan, for instance. And mm-hmm. we really have excellent Japanese Korean translators. And the way they operate, they just go around bookstores in Japan, and then they pick out books that they really like. And then they very actively advocate for those books. And very interestingly, I've noticed this, especially about Japanese Korean translators, is that they don't look for books that will become a hit or are trendy. They look for books that they know Korea doesn't have, that Korea cannot even imagine existing, but will totally blow the minds of Koreans. And so they're like, oh, this is going to be really new and fresh and innovative, and it'll be really fun for Korean readers to read, even though they can't imagine that they will like it now. And that's what I try to do in my practice as well. I don't want to translate like an obvious Korean book, like, I don't know, like Hwang Seok-yong. I have translated Hwang Seok-yong, but like this idea of Korean literature being this like historical, old, cisgender, heterosexual men talking about, you know, their cisgender, heterosexual lives. Like, I don't want to produce that kind of work. I want work that is, I love speculative fiction. I love science fiction, fantasy. So I want to do that kind of work. I want to show the world that we have science fiction, that we have fantasy. I think Cursed Bunny by Bora Chung was the first work by a single author that was Korean science fiction, like into English, certainly in the US and UK. Oh, wait, no. Kim Bo-young published a couple of years before that. So it was one of the first works, let's say. And so I really wanted to showcase the side of Korea that I know and love and the Korean literature that I know and love. I think a lot of people kind of have this misunderstanding about me in that they think that I'm some kind of Korea influencer or a K-lit, like K-pop, like K-books influencer, tastemaker. And I'm like, no, yeah. I honestly don't care about nationalism, and I don't have a particular, I don't think like the Korean language is like all languages are special. Like Korean is special in the sense that all languages are special, but I don't have like this, like we call it kukbong or Korean heroine. Like I don't have Korean heroine, you know, I'm not lost in that euphoria. I love my authors and I love my books and that's it. And so I'm not going to explain Korean culture to you, but I am going to showcase some of the best books that you've ever read in your life. And yeah, that's how I go about it. And that I learned from translators. And I also learned from translators I don't want to emulate, where they do the other thing, where they go for the trendy thing. They go for whatever the Literary Translation Institute of Korea tells them to translate. Like, I don't do that. Like that's, you know, there are plenty of people already do that. There's no like master track into becoming a literary translator. Like I found my way and I suggest other translators do the same.
So way back at the beginning of the episode, you mentioned the kind of like profound whiteness of American publishing, which 100% fair and very true. And also
sadly true.
Yeah, sadly, that's a better framing of it. And also in talking about Korean translators and how they encounter Japanese texts, and they have this strategy of wanting to bring something that's new and that's fresh and that sort of like almost disrupts the Korean reader's sense of what's possible, or, you know, kind of freshen it up in some ways. I think from my perspective over here in the United States right now, a lot of Americans are experiencing an exposure to Korean media that's very new to us, and I think is its own kind of analogous disruption. And I'm sort of curious if you have any thoughts about that, because I don't know that we are in a position where we sit to have a sense of like, are we seeing the equivalent of like the Korean top 40 big hit media, or are we getting a different kind of slice of that kind of creative landscape there?
David Foster Wallace wrote this essay about television. I can't remember the title. It's like E Pluvis Unum. It's like a Latin title and a play on the logo that you guys have on your money.
Sure.
I say your because a lot of people mistake me for American because of the way I sound, but I'm not American. I'm very Korean. I'm a Korean national. I live in Korea. There's nothing American about me aside from my accent. So he wrote this essay. It's a really great essay. And he foretells of a culture that is completely lacking in irony, that is completely what it is on the surface. And it will be global. And it will be global because there is this great platform called television, and also this great platform called the internet. And, you know, and I think he kind of foretells internet streaming in that essay, which was, I believe, written in the 90s. It was written a while ago. And that prophecy has come to pass with K-drama and K-pop, not with Korean literature, because Korean literature is a lot deeper than what it looks like on the surface. But then there are certain works of Korean literature that have done really well, and we call this K-healing. It's a subset of Korean literature where the K-healing is a book where the cover of the book is some kind of capitalist establishment. So if the cover of the book has like a laundromat and it's a Korean translation, then that's K-healing. And there are two, you know, Korean laundromat novels that have done really well. Convenience stores are also a very good storefront. Like bookshops, pottery shops, like this is what K-healing is. And that's sort of like, it's a very surface level of, it's like those books are all vibe. They're all uplifting, bright. They touch upon trauma and they touch upon certain bad things that may have happened to the characters. But then it's, you know, they're about arcs of redemption and whatnot. So I think thanks to global, you know, our globalized platforms, because publishing is now also global. Like, for example, you know, Penguin Random House is owned by a German company, and like Hachette is a French company. And like, so all of these, you know, publishing, all of these places are very, very like globalized now in terms of like the platform, that like you have more of a reach than you used to. And so what kind of products are going to have the most reach? It's going to be like, I don't want to say shallow and superficial, but the kinds of works that are immediately consumable and are just more easily translatable, like literally translatable across cultures. And K-pop, kind of like K-pop, K-drama and K-healing kind of fill that slot. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so that's kind of like my explanation of why Korean cultural products have done so well. It also has to do with the fact that Korea became so rich as a country, you know, financially. And we all live in the global country of capitalism, as Bong Joon-ho once said. And a lot of people are like, oh, we want to emulate Korea. We want to know how they did it. We want this affluent, hyper-capitalist lifestyle. And if Korea was not so financially successful and we still had the same cultural products, K-drama, K-pop, and K-healing would not exist in the form they do today. Like, it just would not. Like, we would not need healing because we have not gone through the meat grinder of capitalism. That's one. And two, no one would care about Korean cultural products because they'd be like, oh, you're some poor country, war-torn, poor country on the edge of the continent. Like, who cares about you people? And indeed, that was the attitude people had towards Korean literature until the 90s.
Yeah. Oof.
I'm just throw it out there, Tracy, by the way. It's not just the television shows and movies and stuff like that. It's also apparently the hot chicken.
Yeah, definitely. Americans are trying really hard to sort of grasp Korean cuisine. And there's a proliferation of different chains that are either nominally or ostensibly of Korean origin, or ones that are just trying to like emulate it. And that has been really interesting to see too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think Korean cuisine is, I don't know how controversial this is going to be, but like when I go to America, I really love Korean American cooking. I really love Korean American restaurants, like restaurants run by Korean Americans.
Yeah.
Because one thing that America has like so clearly over the rest of the world is that you guys have a very high quality of produce. And so you guys make the best, you know, you guys grow the best garlic, you grow the best chilies, you have the best cows and pigs and all of that. And so when you use Korean cooking methods on using American produce, the quality is just like unparalleled throughout the world. And then I'll say things like, oh, you know, I prefer Korean American food to Korean food. And then people are like, oh, we have to throw him into the river or something. But I'm like, no, like we should be FRFR here, because, and we should acknowledge. And the thing about Korean food is that it's very democratic. Like it's not hard to get it right, as long as you have like a good gochujang manufacturer that you go to. Please don't make your own gochujang. Like, you know, I think Gwyneth Paltrow makes her own gochujang, which I feel like it's a mentally healthy thing to do. just get your gochujang from like your nearest H Mart or whatever, and then you can sort of like branch out from there. But yeah, I mean, I could see why Korean food does well in America, but I think we should give credit to the wonderful Korean American chefs and our wonderful American farmers who create all this great produce.
Agreed. There's a comedian that a lot of people send me the reels of. He's got a name that's like an old magician's name. I can't remember his name, but anyway, he did this thing where he's like, I thought I loved Thai food until I went to Thailand. He's like, I've been to Thai restaurants with my girlfriend a ton of times. I love it. It's just, it was like one of my favorite cuisines. And then we went to Thailand and I was like, what's this? This is not what I'm used to. Like, have you tried making it like the authentic way?
Oh, and
it's Lord. Just because like, yeah, because he's.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause we always fuck shit up here, but. anyway.
Yeah. I mean, Thailand has, I don't want to say privilege, but Thailand, well, I guess Thailand was never colonized by an outside European American power. So because they've never been colonized, like, it feels really different there. Like, people's attitudes towards, you know, outsiders are completely different than they are in a place like Korea. Their food culture, their everything culture is just so much more intact and well-preserved and connects. And, you know, Thai people are extremely innovative with their cultural innovations in a way that Koreans really aren't. Like, we Koreans are very conservative about our cultural innovations because, like, we don't want to lose it again. I think that's the mentality behind it.
Sure. And
Koreans' attitude towards Korean culture doing so well overseas, they're like, we're largely proud, but you can see, like, there's a lot of paranoia and there's a lot of concern. There's so much harsh criticism against translators like me who take Korean culture outside and then translate it into, they're all like, why didn't you do it this way? Why didn't you do it that way? And I'm like, oh, so like, and it's really funny for fantasy novels because I'm like, dude, this country is not Korea. This country is a fake country that the author made up.
It's not even a fake Korea. It's just a fake thing.
They're not speaking Korean. They're not, you know, this planet is not planet Earth. Like, I don't know why you feel so whatever about it, but it's because I blame colonialism. Yeah.
I think that kind of like proprietary instinct, like, this belongs to us and it needs to therefore be treated a certain way. I think at root, almost every human being, if they identify with some kind of cultural group, has a certain amount of that. But you're right. And I had not thought of it in those terms of the particular lived experience of, frankly, pretty recent history for Korea and many other places would put you on guard against what does it mean to have things that come from us move out into the rest of the world. That it's not just as simple as saying, we have a cultural export here of sorts. It's created interest. It's you know, to wonder what that interest means and if there could be kind of an undermining aspect to it.
It just comes out in such weird ways. Like, my biggest enemy group in the world is Korean professors in Korea. Oh. So, I mean, I'm married to a professor, but who teaches in Korea.
You're undercover.
Yeah, I'm right under their noses. But the thing is, like, they have this space that they thought that it was theirs and they carved it out and they thought they were the authority of Korean culture, that they were the authority of how a Korean work should be translated. And a lot of them are translators and none of them are successful because I cannot name a single Korean translator who is successful and an academic. And they have like this, and so they're always like writing articles about like mistranslations, so-called mistranslations, which are not mistranslations at all. Translation is, you know, is based on a reader's reading. It's very subjective. As long as the reading is coherent and, you know, the reading, you can argue the reading, it can't really be said to be a wrong reading. I mean, we live in postmodern times. There's no such thing as an objective reading, really. Although, while it feels like I have the objective reading when I'm translating, that's an illusion, right? And them thinking that they have the objective reading, that's an illusion too. And so there's a lot of, there are also certain like Korean diaspora who feel very proprietary towards cultural products and coming from Korea. And they, if I almost have none of this from that sphere, but on the occasion that I do, it's very amusing because, like, I'm, you know, a Korean who lives in Korea. They're once removed. I mean, they did not really grow up in Korea. Some of them don't really speak Korean, and they feel very proprietary towards what I'm doing, like my source work, and want to criticize my translation choices. And I'm like, no, it's I'm very uniquely positioned in the world in that this is what my English sounds like, but at the same time, I'm Korean. So it's you can see them kind of like back down. It's very, so there are all these like dynamics in play, and it's very, very weird. And yeah, it's very tiresome. at the end of the day, though, I love books. I love writing. I love translating. And my greed for those things kind of like carries me through all of that. And if people want to try to take that away from me or try to take it away from me, I don't know, like, you're welcome to try, I guess, but you would have quite an uphill battle. Yeah.
That is the perfect note, I think, to end that discussion on. And among the other things that you cannot take from my cold dead hands are picks of the week, I think.
We'll get to picks of the week. Just hold your horses. We'll get there. Before we do, I wanted to talk to you for just a second about $5. I know. You're shaking your head now. Look, they say that $5 doesn't go as far as it used to, and they're kind of right. Can you get a cup of coffee for $5 these days? Some of you are saying yes. Like a black coffee, right? You could get a small black coffee probably for $5 somewhere. But you're not going to be able to get one of the fancy ones with the stuff in it. Shot of this, shot of that. Those are going to cost you a lot more. So that $5 is not going to get you that. But you know what? There's a place where you can get a ton of value for just $5 a month. And that is patreon.com/functionalnerds. Let me break it down for you. $5 a month and you gain access to things like our super secret Facebook group, which has been going on forever. Our brand new and popular so far, I'm enjoying it, a lot of other people are enjoying it, but our brand new Discord server, which is also super secret. Can't get there from anywhere else. You have to be a patron of the Functional Nerds to get there. You get a monthly video hangout. And those are really cool. That's me and Tracy host. And the patrons like you, if you become one, get to hang out with us. And we all chat and we talk about the things that are going on in the world and have a little bit of a nerdy conversation. We talk about books sometimes and movies and other things. So you get that for $5. And on top of all of that, one of our most popular things that listeners absolutely love, you get the Patreon exclusive episode of the pod that we call Just Us. That is just me and Tracy talking about stuff. And by the way, if you joined today, you would get all the back episodes of that, I believe, which is kind of cool. And that's all for $5 a month. I mean, come on. What are you waiting for? Head over to patreon.com/functionalnerds and help us keep the lights on and keep this thing we call the Functional Nerds Podcast rolling on. While you do that, you don't have to like pull your earbuds out or stop listening. We're just going to jump right into the other thing that listeners really, really love. It's called Picks of the Week.
Patrick, can you start us off?
Yeah, I'm going to piggyback on. So we had Molly Tanzer on a couple weeks ago, and Molly picked Frieren, which is an anime show that's available in the US on Netflix. And there's only 2 seasons, 28 episodes. And she talked about it and it sounded really good. So I decided to give it a shot. I love that show.
Oh, wow.
It's a fun, fun show. And this is it feels to me like it's the RPG parts of the role playing session. Mm-hmm. And then every once in a while, there's a little bit of a fight. But mostly it's the other parts of when you're playing a role playing game. And it as she explained, it does start at the end of the 10-year adventure. So it's a group of adventurers. They've been out. They've saved the world. They've been doing this for 10 years and they come home. And then the elf is like, okay, I'm going to go now, and just kind of starts walking. And it's all about the fact that because she has such a long life, that the other people that she meets in this party and that she spent 10 years with, that's just like the smallest fraction of her life. And when she comes back to town to visit them, they're all old or dead or dying. Like, and it's just this, it's these little moments in her life. And it actually becomes more about her actually learning to build relationships with these people and kind of spending more time with them as she takes on a new adventuring group. But again, it's more about the role play session part of the game. And then like every once in a while, they'll just kind of show like the end of the battle where she's defeated something. But it's fun. And I like it a lot. And again, to Molly's point, the main character, Freerun, she cannot tell a mimic from a real chest. So every iron chest that she sees, she thinks is real. And then the mimic gets her and they have to rescue her from the mimic, which is hilarious. So anyway, Freerun, it's on Netflix and it's well worth your time.
Awesome. All right. So, Anton, what has been bringing you joy?
I have been. So we just moved into this housing, essentially, because my husband changed institutions. And it has one of the biggest research libraries in Korea, and I have membership in it now. As an alumni here, my alumnus here myself. And then so I've just been like indiscriminately checking out books. And I know I'm kind of late to the party, but I just finished reading The Secret Lives of Church Ladies by Disha Filial.
Oh, okay.
And I really love this book. It's about queer Black women who grew up in church, church households, and how they deal with like being ostracized or being exiled, or how to like, you know, reconcile with your families or not. Different kinds of relationships and just the diversity of sexuality and lives being lived. And it was really moving. And I just like finished it in two sittings.
Wow.
And, and I'm also reading a bunch of Korean books, trying to see if there's another project on the horizon. And I just sold a couple of books this year. So we're looking at manuscripts right now where I say we because I'm working with an editor now, and we're like looking at them and we're like, okay, how do we make this more, I don't want to say palatable, like how do we make this more accessible? Because I'm all about access. Like how do we make this more accessible to, sure, to an English reader? Mm-hmm. Because I do not want to put out an academic translation. I never want to do that. I want to give readers a really good reading experience where they'll learn something, feel something, you know? Mm-hmm. That's kind of like what's been the good things that have been going on.
That's awesome.
That is cool. So I am not in any form of university housing or anything, but I am definitely co-opted right now by the academic world because we are just a couple weeks away from graduation at the boarding school where I teach, which means all the final projects and things are rolling in, a lot of grading and things to do. It's always kind of stick your head down and just plow through and no way but through. And at this time of year, I find myself having to change up my routine so I can kind of push through things and just kind of wake myself up in different ways. And as anybody who's listened to the podcast for a long time knows, I am an inveterate tea drinker, never been a coffee person, always been a tea person. And I have very recently discovered the joy of milk oolong. which is not a, I've always loved oolongs. And for those who are unfamiliar and are, don't speak tea, oolongs are teas that are deliberately oxidized. So they are dried in a way to expose them to sort of like maximal air, as opposed to kind of, other techniques that are sometimes used. And so that creates like a different flavor profile and slightly different things to caffeine and so on and so on. A milk oolong, I'm going to confess, I don't know enough about the process that goes into it, but it's called a milk oolong, not because it actually turns out milky per se, but it tends to look like a green tea after it steeps, but it has this kind of creamy note to it, although again, no dairy, it's just the thing itself, and even a bit of like a hit of pineapple or fruit to it, although again, it's just the thing itself. So if you can find a milk oolong tea somewhere, my brothers and sisters, in steeping leaves, oh my god. It has been kind of life-changing for me over these last couple weeks, and is probably going to be the only thing that keeps me pushing to the end. So I would check it out.
I doubt that it's on the same level, Tracy, but I did have an Arnold Palmer today. So
I mean, everybody has to have something to bring them joy. Well, Anton, we have had such a great conversation with you. Thank you so much for taking the time to join us. Please make sure that you tell us now where we can find the things that you translate, your own writing. People are going to want to know where to keep up with you and all your super cool stuff.
Sure. My novel, Toward Eternity, is out in Nomad Edition. This is like this tiny little book that's like the size of the palm of your hand.
Oh, wow.
That edition is now available at bookstores everywhere. You'll love it. The Nomad edition also includes The Magical Girl Retires by Park Soryeon, which I also translated. So grab those two when you see them, you know, at your local bookstore. They're very, very cute, very readable. You can put them in like the tiniest handbag that you own and it will still fit. All my books... Information on all my books are available on antonher.com. I'm on Instagram and Blue Sky at antonher. And If We Cannot Go at the Speed of Light is available now in respectable bookstores everywhere across the US, UK, Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, India, and wherever good English books are sold.
Nice.
It's fantastic. I can't speak to a Nomad edition. That's not even a term I knew existed before, but I did get Toward Eternity on Audible. So I know what I'll be listening to this week when I am driving into work.
Oh, they're amazing. They won a Golden Earphones Award like right off the bat. Yeah, they're an award-winning cast. They're really, really wonderful. I love what they did so much.
Fantastic.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed this episode or any of our episodes, please consider sharing it with your friends on social media and give us a like or some stars on the platform or the podcatcher that you're listening to us on. Those likes help with the nasty little algorithm so new people can find us when searching for good stuff to listen to. If you'd like to keep up with the Functional Nerds on social media, the official podcast socials are as follows. At the Functional-Nerds on Facebook, at FunctionalNerds_podcast on Instagram. Shut up. I couldn't get the same one. It just didn't work that way, so hush. And you know what? It's going to get worse here. And at TheFunctionalNerds.BlueSky, which is BSKY, .social. I know, I couldn't keep it copacetic. I tried, but hush. Tracy and I have our own accounts. We're on Facebook, Instagram, and Blue Sky. You can find us by searching, if you want me, it's ATFMB, because that's just my handle everywhere I go. Or you can search for Tracy Townsend and find Tracy on social as well. Our Patreon helps keep the lights on, and new episodes like this one coming out week after week, which we've been pretty good at. I mean, we're very consistent. So you might consider checking us out over at patreon.com/functionalnerds just to support the pod and help us out there, you know? It does help. Thanks again for listening. And I have one question for you before I go. Is it baseball season yet?
Mr. Carpiers.
You got it right. How about that?
Yeah.
You can call me Cannoli Joe.
Hello, Cannoli Joe.
If you've never listened to the podcast, there's two different styles here. There's Tracy, who does prep work and comes up with some very thoughtful questions. And then, oh, squirrel.
Oh, for God's sake, Patrick Louise.
Hello, Patrick. It is I, Clayface.
Okay. That's probably a good enough signal.
When someone comes up to me and says, hey, I really love what you do, I'm like, I'm sorry, do you know who I, like, I think you have me confused with someone else.
The whiz bang and the gosh wow and the sense of wonder stuff.
My favorite thing about time travel is I actually had a time travel joke for you guys, but you didn't like it.
I'm so excited.